So, that's the introduction, David. And is this thing actually... Oh, of course, it's not speakers, it's just recording. Okay. So, as you said, Roger Penrose has this intriguing idea that in order to explain human brain, and in particular consciousness, you have to understand quantum gravity. And he gives, superficially, very logical reasons for that. The question is whether it's really right. Okay, so let's see if I can. Now, normally, let's backtrack off Penrose, and let's give the let me summarize the conventional viewpoint that says Penrose is talking nonsense. Well, at least if someone said that, they would be talking nonsense. Then I'd like to give a little summary of what he actually, of his argument. And so it looks a very nice, watertight argument. The question is, where does the argument go wrong? What can go wrong? And then we'll have to get into a little of the theory of computation, a thing called Turing's halting theorem, and just investigate exactly the chain of logic where one goes from this completely rigorous, simple, and unambiguous theorem to making statements about real-world computers. And there's, I think, a loophole there that you have to look a little hard to find it in the first instance. So let's start off with the conventional viewpoint. Suppose you've got, let's say, a theory of everything, okay? Now, typically, you don't want to do all your calculations with a theory of everything. You tend to reduce it to some other theory, maybe by more than one step. For example, you could get down to the standard model, and you'd think of the standard model as being some useful low-energy approximation to the complete theory of the world. Now, even the standard model is too hard if you're a chemist, you're trying to do molecular physics and such like. So you reduce that down to things like non-relativistic quantum mechanics. If you're a chemist trying to deal with large groups of atoms, many electrons, even that's rather hard to calculate. So you simplify things a bit more. And somewhere along the way, you get to biology. Okay, so the idea is you've got an ultimate microscopic theory, but trying to do first principles calculations right there, direct in the ultimate microscopic theory or in whatever, if you're trying to do calculations several levels down, you're giving yourself a lot more work than you need to do, and in each of these steps, there are also conceptual things you have to bring in. You know, if you're working with chemistry, it's probably a good idea to figure out what the concept of the various types of chemical bonding is. You don't just want to treat non-relativistic quantum mechanics of a large number of particles as a pure black box. You've got to organize your thoughts. On the other hand, whenever you get up to these big levels, but let's think of biology. You know, does it really matter whether we have all the substructure under the biological system? Or do you just need, or would some other set of theories that had approximately the same qualitative behavior be equally good here? And you'd normally say yes, because otherwise making a little change here, sort of one part in a million change in some parameter of the standard model, put it in some fairly chaotic big system, and you're going to make some, you know, might not make any qualitative changes, but in the detailed behavior of anything from biology to the weather, we are, a little changes here can get amplified. The systems are very unstable, and to understand the behavior of big systems, you have to look at the appropriate global properties, not the microscopic properties. So, and also we know in biological systems, they've got very powerful error-correcting mechanisms. If a few neurons in my brain or David Gross's brain die, it's not going to be a disaster, whereas if it was one of our desktop computers, you'd probably have to get it repaired or even replaced. So biological systems have a lot of error-correcting mechanisms so that they can live, reproduce for many, many generations. And so if you make a little error in the underlying theory, well, that's going to be no worse than a slight perturbation in a few cells dying because of a cosmic ray coming through or something. The errors in what we know or don't know about the underlying theories shouldn't matter for biological purposes.
And it's not a logically tied argument.
It's not a logically tied argument.
If you were, say, a change in alpha,
but yeah, there's certain things that have to be fine-tuned. Or if we say alpha does change, maybe our biology would look rather different. But we don't know if we just changed alpha a little, whether that would upset the whole of the evolution of the universe. Some of it would, I agree. But at some point, given what we've got, there are all kinds of errors in the underlying theory that are not going to affect this, provided, let's say, the parameters, some appropriate parameters are correct. But a lot of details don't matter. Yeah, I would hate it if we had to get our QCD calculations correct to one part in even 10 to the 2 in order to handle biology. Because we don't normally know how to do things that accurately. Okay, so it would be surprising if we had to know all the fine details of theory here to explain what's going on here. We should be able to chop off things here and say, even make some fairly crude model of neurons and all neural networks and so on, provided these big systems have approximately the right qualitative properties. Okay. Penrose's argument basically says what I've said is just complete nonsense, even though much of this is what the way we normally conventionally work. So what is his argument? Well, first of all, he says there's some theorems due to Gödel, famous theorems, and Turing, which, perfectly good mathematical theorems, rigorous and everything you could want, and if you interpret them colloquially, they say machines can't think, which particularly means you can never build a computer that's going to be as powerful at things humans do. And if one's talking about mathematical theorems and so on, that means in particular they're not going to be able to be anywhere near as good as humans at proving mathematical theorems. And that's ultimately the content of the theorem there. Now, then Penrose says, if one's got some theory of physics, a microscopic theory of physics, all the theories we know are computational. So we say microphysics is computational. So we can build, that says that in principle we could build a theory that solved our theory of everything, did everything here, and with a big enough computer, big computer, we can solve biology from first principles. Now, you might not want to build the computer, of course, but we're in the middle of a mathematical argument that says you could try it. But if we solve biology, we have artificial intelligence as every bit as good as the intelligence we've got. And then we've got a contradiction with Gödel and particularly Turing, which says machines can't think, we've just created a machine if we've got that can think. We've got it on our computer.
Can you remind me how the human brain avoids being a machine?
Does it? Well, okay, the question is, we apparently have a contradiction. I'm going to go through this. Okay, that's... Now, so we have a contradiction. That's Penrose's argument in outline, and of course he's got much fancier words to explain this.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. How do you know that such a computer wouldn't require the number of elements which is greater than the number of particles in the universe?
Well, you have, maybe the computer's run by God, so it's outside this universe. Okay, the question is, we don't have to imagine that the computer's inside our present universe. We just have to say someone's running a computer somewhere. You know, it's just like us trying to simulate some piece of physics system. We can step outside the system and try and do something that's isomorphic to what's happening in the system. So the idea here is, okay, that's one of the objections, of course, that's raised. But the idea is the theorems up here are very general theorems, apply to all possible computers, not just the ones we can build in our real world. So it's a mathematical theorem, so it applies to other situations. So you can imagine if the universe is some big simulation run on God's computer, the computer you need is not part of the present universe. But the mathematics still applies.
He's just saying this is a mathematical problem.
Yes.
Independent of the universe.
Exactly. Yeah, so whether we can run the computer, I agree, is a big issue. So this is maybe not an engineering problem, not a practical one. Nevertheless, so the question is, in order to get the artificial intelligence here, because it comes from solving a system in the way biology solves, it says whatever we've solved on our computer is essentially isomorphic biology. And so we've got to break the link somewhere. Now, Penrose says everything is solid in this argument except this statement, because we don't know everything about microscopic physics. So he says we're going to have to change the most fundamental parts of physics in order that they're of a kind that can't be calculated computationally, can't be solved computationally. So Penrose says we must give up point number two. Okay. Now, as far as you can see, and we have sort of, it's not implausible, the only place where we've got available for giving up things is at the most microscopic level, and that's coming down to the area of quantum gravity. So he says, we have to change quantum gravity, and by this chain of argument, that immediately says, breaks this link completely.
Now, what would it mean to have a theory of physics that was not computational?
Good question. But I think we just need to leave that one to Penrose.
But does he explain what it means?
Well, he doesn't give some explanation, but I'm not quite sure I can reproduce it.
Well, for example, with these theorems that say machines can't think, that includes, for example, quantum computing and
It
pertains to anything.
Yeah, because quantum mechanics is computation, so I've got a quantum computer. I can always perform all that quantum. If I want to check whether it's working, I can do the standard computer engineering trick of simulating my new machine on the old machine. It's terribly inefficient, but as far as I can see, that's a matter of efficiency, not a matter of mathematical principle. So that doesn't break the chain of argument. I'm proposing the actual flaw occurs here. Now, that goes against a lot of what people say, so I'll have to explain. And obviously, people who've objected to Penrose's conclusions have tried to put in the same break. But unfortunately, Penrose keeps having a nice comeback. He's pretty smart, of course. But I think, nevertheless, one can break that chain of argument.
Perhaps you can remind them of the purpose of contradiction for low signal people.
Okay, contradiction basically say, if we've got conventional theory of physics, we can, they're all of a kind which we can at least conceive of solving the theory, the complete microscopic theory, from first principles on a computer. Mm-hmm. Yep. It means an enormously much bigger computer than you'd care to build, but you could do it as a piece of mathematics. You come in, and then on this computer, this enormously big computer, you have things that are doing exactly the same thing the biological organisms are doing. In particular, they're going to think and have consciousness. Now, it may be a little difficult to figure out how you do your input and output, but let's leave that as a separate issue. But never, you could conceive of finding ways of doing that. So you've got something here that's got things going on that are entirely equivalent to what we're doing now. Thinking, being conscious, proving mathematical theorems. And Penrose being a mathematician obviously think that's a very important thing that humans do, not unreasonably. So we've got a machine here that does the whole of biology. Provided the microscopic theories of physics ultimately underlie biology, as is commonly thought in by physicists.
So, I mean, essentially what he's saying is that the reason humans can think is because they are consequences of microscopic laws that are not computational.
Precisely.
And that therefore, whatever he's giving up at the microscopic level,
yes,
is affecting neurotic,
yes,
behavior at a scale which is...
Yeah. Exactly, and he even wants to identify structures in cells, these microtubules, that are actually responsible for that.
So can you remind what is it that was achieved by human which machines cannot achieve?
Well, that's this point number one, the Turing,
so
Gödel's theorem. I'm going to come there, that's my next step. So the weak link, I think, is here. Now, background here is in early 20th century, late 19th century, a lot of mathematicians and philosophers were trying to figure out what exactly is mathematics. How do you make sure you're doing it right? To what extent is intuitive? To what extent do you have perfect 100% rigor? And Gödel's theorem, which even if you don't know what it is still fairly famous, puts limits to the perfect rigor of mathematics. Now, Turing got in the early days of artificial computation, and he was wanting to figure out what can be computed, what can't be computed. And he was able to reformulate Gödel's theorem in a rather neat way that I can actually put on a single, well, I can fit it in on the blackboard. So, and I think we need to go through that. So the idea is if you're talking about computers, obviously it's useful to know, for example, does a computer program you've just written obey its specification? Can you go through the code of the program and prove by ordinary mathematics that the program does what you expect it to do? And you want to know properties of the program. Now, one of the simplest properties of the program is, does it complete its task? Does it end? Or does it keep going? Does it end up in an infinite loop or something? So let's suppose we imagine, as a background, we have theorem-proving software, mathematical software. Well, things like Mathematica, but maybe something much fancier than Mathematica and all Maxima, all the rest of them. And then we can imagine putting this mathematical software to use to automatically check the code of computer programs. That's a staple of computer science, trying to do exactly that. So in order to understand this, Turing invented the concept of a Turing machine. Now, some discussions of this whole subject then get into a whole long song and dance about exactly Turing's definition of what a Turing machine is. But it doesn't matter. Turing machine is just a formalization of what it means to have an algorithm to calculate something. And for practical purposes, modulo a little subtleties we're going to come to later, that's essentially a computer program. And these concepts are actually equivalent, because one of the things Turing said is, suppose I've got a computing language, Fortran, Pascal, C, C++, BASIC, whatever. They're all equivalent in what they can do. So he defined things in terms of one particular hardware configuration, which was nice for proving theorems with. We can talk nowadays in terms of whatever computer language we like. And the basic argument he had that all equivalent is simply to say, if you've got any sufficiently powerful language, and all general purpose computing languages are sufficiently general, actually tech turns out to be Turing equivalent. Now, you don't want to try programming your lattice gauge theory calculations in tech unless you're really forced to, but it's permitted, and you can do it. As long as you don't mind waiting a long time and have got sufficiently much memory and hard disk. So the idea is, and the proof of the equivalence is almost trivial. Once you've got a sufficiently powerful programming language, you can simply write an emulator for the language you're really interested in. So if you've got a Macintosh computer on your desk, you can write an emulator program that will make it emulate an old-fashioned IBM mainframe and run IBM mainframe computers on software on it, or vice versa. So any computer can do what any other computer to do, provided you don't care how fast they run, provided you forget an important engineering issue, and provided you allow as much storage as the thing needs, which is, again, practical limitation. But we're doing mathematics here. We don't have to be quite so practical. And of course, if you say certain things can't be computed, it's no point trying. If something can be computed, you find it takes a long time, you can try and ask, how do you speed it up? How do you lose less resources? But if you can't compute it at all, no matter how hard you try, it's not worth bothering. So next, suppose we think of a program as being, a program P, as being some set of computer code. You give it some data, and let's call the data N. Program takes the data, goes and does some calculations. When it's finished, it comes back and gives you the answer. Okay. Program to compute the sine of an angle. You know, you give it the number of degrees, it goes away and computes, comes back and gives you a number. And that's the classical idea of an algorithm. Now, you can ask, does the program actually finish its job? Okay, so the idea then, the Gödel thing, and the Turing's use of it, there's an ingenious idea. Suppose we find a particular computer program, and let me just for a moment call this, let me stay over here. So we have a computer program that takes some data, and the data happen to be the code for a program, okay, and the data for the program. Okay? And we'd like this program to check whether tests whether P of N holds. Well, halts is a bit uninteresting. Let's just make things a little more interesting. Plays the national anthem. We'll give some signal it's got its job done. So there's some signal the program's halted. We're all used to those when we run programs. So we've got a program here that uses some mathematical software, so Mathematica plus plus or something, and works out properties of programs. And, well, if we've got general purpose software, we can ask some fairly elementary question.
You're supposed to be an algorithm that, given a program and its input tests, can tell you whether it halts or not for any program in any input.
Yes. Or maybe it'll come back and tell you, this problem's too hard for me. Or it might come back and say, this program has got a syntax error in it. Or whatever.
Meaning it's a universal program for all programs?
Yeah.
Some universal.
Well, Fortran compiler, for example, is a universal compiler. Give it any Fortran program, it'll process it. Now, what the answer will be is the interesting issue. So it's saying, here's a, it's like taking, let's have a little subroutine that can, or function that computes the logarithm of a real number. You give it a negative number. Now, it's going to object, but you're entitled to give it any real number. So what I'm saying, I've got a software here, program, let's say, that's given the source code for a program and some data, and the aim of the program is to determine whether this new program P halts when it's got data in. Now,
and you always halts? Well, that's the problem.
There's a problem there. Okay, but at this point, we're not saying whether you actually does determine this, because it may not be able to do it. And in fact, we're going to get limits on this. But we simply, first thing, we can imagine writing programs, and we know for some programs, here's a trivial example. Compute sine of x, and then we can imagine having a little loop here that says, sum equals 0 for n equals 1 to some suitable maximum, add to the sum plus x to the n over n factorial. Okay, and if you, say, set the number, have some suitable condition for terminating the loop, you can go through this and prove that this little subroutine actually terminates, and you can prove it gets the right answer. That's not very hard. So simple programs, you can do this by hand, and presumably you can write programs to do such tasks. So now, Turing's idea, very neat idea, is to say, let's specify a program T, which takes one argument, and let's say its specification is that it halts if and only if it has a proof, has a correct proof, that the program, let's just give an argument P, P of P halts. I've got to get this right. Does not halt. Get my negatives in the right place here. That's critical. Okay. So, we can imagine a program. We can imagine even a conventional compiler, C compiler, Fortran compiler, whatever, that looks at the code you write and notices somewhere in the middle of the code, you get down to something, you loop back, and that loop goes on forever. And if it's a simple enough loop, you can detect that sort of thing mechanically, and you can get that sort of error in real programs. And it's quite nice if your compiler detects that. Okay, so certain kinds of saying programs get into infinite loops, it's a good idea. You can actually find out whether they get infinite loops and say this is maybe an undesirable condition. So you can imagine attempting to construct a program, T, that looks at some other program and halts, in other words, finishes its job if it has a correct proof that this program P, when presented with the data, actually does not halt.
What data?
The data, the source code of the program itself. So the argument here, this is a computer program. Or at least let's say it's a string of characters that may be a computer program, maybe or not. So let's just say string of characters. The program treats the string of characters as a program, maybe a legal program, maybe an illegal program, and determines whether when this string of characters is treated as a program, and this program is given the data P, it determines whether that program does not halt.
So it's not enough that it determines whether or not it halts. You're saying that it'll stop only if this thing does not halt.
Yes. Slightly dumb kind of program, I agree. However, this is the Gödel argument, basically, in disguise.
And these P's are both identical.
Yes.
Okay. What?
The program is, think of the P as a possible theorem-proving program, and the program's given itself to work on.
Could you make that a T of T?
Yeah, T of T. And then we're going to give T of T. You've already seen the argument, of course. Okay. Now.
Don't construct the arguments
necessarily? Not necessarily, but let's say we can.
That's fine. We can ignore its argument.
Well, it doesn't have to do anything with the argument. But let's say we've chosen a language in which programs have arguments. Well, because I might want to give it another argument. Let me show you the next step. So, at this point, I'm just reviewing. So, the question is, does T of T halt? So I've got a program here that investigates properties of some whatever program I choose to tell it about. But I can choose to ask it to investigate itself.
So did you say that you could only put in programs that could be written down, like in machine code or something?
Yes.
So how do we know that we can write T down?
Well, I mean, by definition, a program is something I can write down. So if I don't know how to write the program down, I've not got anything. I'm not calling the program.
So can things that are quantum computing programs programs?
Yes, because you can specify them. And, well, from the point of Penrose's argument, I could write a classical computer that would emulate the quantum computer. So that is how I think Penrose would argue there, that the quantum computer is improving your ability to compute quantitatively, but not qualitatively. Interesting to see whether, in fact, there are any loopholes there, whether the quantum computers are qualitatively as well as quantitatively more powerful. But let me not address that just at the moment. Okay, now, well, we can look at this and say, we give this program itself to compute. What happens if the program halts? If T of T halts, we look at the specification, it's got a correct proof that T of T doesn't halt. Halt. Contradiction, therefore the program can't halt. Perfectly normal condition for a computer program for just doing something and not stopping, something complicated. Okay, so we've proved in about two lines that this program presented with data, which is itself, does not halt.
Does this count as a proof that it does not halt?
Yes. I maybe skipped over a little too much of the detail.
If there is such a program, then it doesn't halt.
Then it doesn't halt when presented with itself as data.
Yeah.
Okay.
You won't argue that this program doesn't agree.
I'm not arguing whether the program is... Well, I'm even arguing if I allow the program to be simple enough that it works on very simple programs and fails on complicated programs. I would argue such programs exist because, if nothing else, it can simply look at all... It can simply have a repertoire of programs it knows about or it responds to a subset of my programming language. Okay. Yeah, but we have to look very carefully at the statement of this theorem. If it says that if it's managed to show that P of P does not halt, then the program will halt. But suppose it does not have a proof. Suppose it has absolutely no idea what to do with this program. It's simply going to go on forever and ever. For example, well, let me maybe write down a program that might do this. The point is, this is a rather a dumb kind of specification for a program. You know, if your boss asked you, write a program like this, you would tell it...
We just write a program on an infinite loop.
Exactly! Exactly. A program with an infinite loop obeys the specification.
Right.
It's not saying it works correctly for every program. It just has to know that on some programs it gets the right answer, and on other programs it doesn't give you an answer at all. So we say, either correct answer, it either knows the answer about not halting, or it doesn't tell you any information. Yep. P of P halts, T... Okay, so let's see what we can do. If T of P halts, does not halt, if it halts, then we can say P of P does not halt. But if it's over here, we have zero information. And in fact, we don't know whether we might just not have waited long enough. If the program's going to take a billion years to do the calculation, we've only got 100. We still have no information. Okay. Now, of course, that's a pretty dumb specification. Suppose we have...
But you do have that T of T cannot halt.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the only thing you have.
Yes. So, in fact, if I have a program that simply goes into an infinite loop and never gives me any information...
That's...
It obeys the specification and obeys my little one-line theorem. So suppose I have some smart programming software, and the first line is call Mathematica plus plus whatever with an argument, prove that P of P holds. Well, you can ask it a question. Okay. So we come back with an error. We come back with a message. Now, you can imagine three things. If it comes back with a message, if the answer is no, then you exit or halt. Okay, you got supposedly correct software. Else, you've either got a yes answer or, let's say, an error message. Okay, because if you've got general purpose software, it at least has to say, you're asking me a bad question. It's not a possible question to give an answer to, a self-contradictory question or something, or error message. Loop forever. So I've got a pretty dumb program. You don't like programs that simply go into infinite loops. But, so I put a little wrapper around some much better code. And this is enough to do what I want here. So this is an unambiguous mathematical theorem. Question is, then we say, we, sitting at this board, sitting in this room, have been able to prove this theorem. The same program has not been able to prove this theorem, because if it was able to prove it, it would halt. So T was not able to prove T of T doesn't halt. Now, that's a little difficult to pass. We're saying here, there's a theorem that we proved and the program didn't. Here's the theorem, and we're saying the program couldn't prove this theorem. So we're more powerful than this program.
But we forced it to be self-referential, we're not.
Yeah. Agreed. We're in, and with this self-referentiality, we're in very dangerous territory. All the philosophers and mathematicians, particularly early 20th century, are very well aware of this. So it's dangerous territory. But if you look at everything here and look at some practical examples, we're just this side of the manifestly paradoxical aspect, I think. But you're right, self-referential, it's very dangerous territory. So, yeah. On the other hand, self-referential programs are not unknown, because if you go to sort of compiler manufacturers, someone who writes compilers for computer languages, one standard technique of developing compilers is to have the compiler compile itself. You've got an old version of the compiler, a new version of the compiler. New version of the compiler does a better job than the old compiler, but you get a program that processes programs, and you get the program to process itself. So the self-referentiality is not paradoxical of itself.
If you want to compare it to a person, you should force the person to make a statement about whether
they
themselves...
I'm coming there. So, the theorem is unambiguous. The deduction that computers can't think is, I think, the dangerous point. And let me... And this, I've got to be just a little careful I say this all right. So I had a nice smart program here. I put a dumb wrapper around it. In normal computer programming setups, that was legal, correct.
So this theorem says then that there are programs that computers can't prove, but it's true.
Yes. And in fact, there's actually a perfectly correct statement that there are theorems that we can prove that algorithms in exactly Turing sense can't prove. Now, question is, but there's a loophole here. Now, let's not worry about the mathematics just for the moment, but let's think of this problem as scientists. Now, we know whenever we do science, there are errors around. You know, if I have the standard model, Schrodinger equation, Newtonian mechanics, whatever, whatever we say is always provisional. It may be as accurate as we know how to do things, but we know if we wait long enough, we'll find some errors in what we do. So any useful scientific statement has to be stable or robust against errors, at least of certain kinds of errors. Now, in fact, fine-tuning of things you have to be very careful about. Now, we've got a problem here. We've got a program, presumably an enormously long, complicated program, pages, pages of source code, gigabytes, terabytes perhaps. And we're giving an argument that has to be exactly the same program, identically the same 10 to the 12 or whatever bits. You've got an enormous fine-tuning of the argument here. If this T, if the argument here is just one bit off compared with this program, you've no contradiction. So clue here, one of the clues for me here is, well, it's a self-referentiality, and it's a very highly tuned self-referentiality. That's, and so we have to say, if we're applying this to the real world, we've got danger. Now, let's, now I just have to watch my time here. Now, the trick is the following. If you look at what Turing meant by an algorithm, he said it's something where you provide it with some data, it goes away, thinks, does stuff, comes back with an answer. Now, if you think of your average, that applies to quite a few programs, for instance, a lot of scientific computations. But there are a whole lot of other things you do on a computer that are highly interactive. So you've got, well, I'm going to call these closed Turing machines, like closed thermodynamic systems. You've got some data, you put it in when it starts, program runs, and you get output. That's closed. But there are also programs that give you output, and they're continually interacting with you. The average text editor or word processor is a good example. So I'll call these open Turing machines. If you go back and look at Turing's definition of an algorithm, it's the closed kind. This is a classical Turing machine. The open Turing machines are not part of the definition. Because you set up the computation, and you know what's going to happen until you know what the user's reply to all your prompts is.
But isn't that equivalent to a bunch of closed Turing machines just
Why? Well, look, there's some cases it is.
Interaction is like an output that provides data for the next.
Yeah, but the output here goes to something outside the machine. And let's say the output is you. I ask you a question.
So I am a Turing machine.
Ah. But, okay. You see how this is exactly how Penrose tries to get around these arguments. So let me do two cases. Two parts to this. The first is, one objection that's been raised to Penrose's argument, is that I've got some artificial intelligence, some attempted artificial intelligence. Normally you don't want to program all the details of that. You want to say, you get the general principles right, and you get this system to be trained on an environment. So you can imagine an environment here. This open Turing machine has to couple to the environment. Okay, very good. But this is where just the argument that the environment as a Turing machine works fine. You say, let's just put a simulated environment, and then for this part of the system, we've converted the openness into closedness. Very good. So I call that the flight simulator trick. Okay. If I'm a pilot and I want to learn how to fly a jumbo jet or a new jet, do I go out and learn on a jumbo jet? Or do I go and learn on a good flight simulator? It's actually possible to learn completely on the flight simulator. It's a lot cheaper if I make a mistake, a lot less fatal. Okay, so that can be done. And the environment, the important thing here, the environment doesn't have to be... The environment can be dumber than the thing here. Students aren't always dumber than their teachers. Okay, but now we're still, but now there's still a problem. We want to tell this Turing machine to prove some mathematical theorem. Okay, now suppose I've endowed Institute for Theoretical Physics at Santa Barbara. I get people set up, interacting, doing physics. But I have in the back of my mind, I'd like to get them to prove some theorem on something. Now, how do I get the message in? I set it up, they're interacting, how do I get a message in? Now, you know what typically happens? If some outsider you've never heard of maybe sends you a letter, maybe sends an email, I have this amazing conjecture, I would like a proof of it. You know, you average crackpot. Message straight in the wastebasket, either electronic or the physical one. Okay. So you're going to have a little difficult. And remember, if you set up this machine, the way we're thinking of it, we might set up some kind of, well, neural thing or something or other, where we're programming things like neurons. You know, we'll all talk about synaptic weights, connections, topology of the neural network, and all that sort of stuff, staple stuff at the current workshop, in fact. And if you've got a whole lot of code that does this sort of thing, you know, we can imagine a statement, you can imagine computer stopping, asking for some input, and you can give it a command, increase the weight of neuron 9 billion blah, 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 by 10%. That will fit perfectly well into simulating one of these neural kinds of systems on a digital computer. That kind of input you can get very easily. But if you have everything programmed at this micro level and you want to get the system prove Fermat's last theorem, you're not communicating with the synapses, you're communicating with whatever things you've created in this machine. And so you've got to be a little more subtle. You know, you can go in with a debugger. Watch this program work, or whatever you have to do if it's something more biological, you have to use the right kind of probes. And then you can, then you can go and maybe change somebody's email message. Put an email message in someone's inbox or something. You change something. But you have to do something at the high level. Okay, so you've got this system, it's running, you look at it, and when it's in an appropriate state for doing mathematics, you look at the system, that's a form of output, you provide a message. Okay, so you put in someone's, whatever the equivalent for these beasts of their local mailboxes, you put a message in. Now you've got to adjust the message to something they're susceptible to. And then, if you get an arbitrary message, I'm interested in this theorem. About the first thing that typically happens is, my experience with this kind of problem is people normally won't really want to talk about some different problem. Is this what you really meant? You know, if you're, it's like you assign a problem to a student. Student comes back in 2 weeks and says, this didn't work out. Didn't you mean to look at non-abelian gauge theories instead of abelian gauge theories? Or something much less trivial. So anytime you've got a boss assigning a problem to an employee or equivalent, if it's any serious scientific, mathematical, or whatever issue, you then need this sequence of interactions with the thing or being that's assigning the problem. Okay, perfectly good. But that means you've got an open system here. And so the quiz, that looks like an insoluble problem. But The answer is, if you've got an open system, can you always enclose it in a closed system? So we've got the boss here. So the boss determines when the open system is an appropriate state for solving mathematical theorems, when it's matured, learned. In comes the theorem. But then we need some interaction. Okay. Now the problem is, how do we determine what these interactions are? Now, here we're dealing with a potentially intelligent system. So it's going to come back with totally unexpected responses. So, but we want something that makes a Turing machine, and we've got, we need a boss in here. And we have to see, if we want to avoid an infinite regress, I think we have to say the boss here is going to be dumber than the system here. So this is our new improved artificial intelligence system. This is the previous version. Okay, so the problem here is we may get questions that are rather difficult. So how do we figure out what the questions are? We don't know. Well, one thing is just we put the input in, we set up the system, let it run, and see what output we get. Then we get the output, maybe in the form of a question, then we figure out what the next input is. And we say, well, when we run it, we put this input in, we get some output, then we know what program, what response to put. So we record, so we have problem, input here, then when we get a question, we put on, we basically make the boss an answering machine. When it gets the first question, here's the correct answer. So this is like politicians going in for a news conference. They get programmed with answers to likely questions from their staff. So maybe we can call this the presidential news conference trick. Or maybe just the word processor demo trick. You know, if you've got a word processor, interactive program, you want to show it off to your customers, you've just built one, you want to sell it, you can show how it deals with things. So you can set it up with some simulated input, let it go down to an error, error message comes out, you have an appropriate response ready, and you can demonstrate this program, errors and how they get responded to. Or, so let's say, the word processor demo method. Okay, so far so good. We've got a closed system now. This is the closed Turing machine. Now, our problem, now let's go back and ask what we're trying to do. We were trying to give this system something to prove that involved the whole system. And this is where we get into problems with the self-referentiality. The real system we were interested in was this opening, this open Turing machine. Let's call it T sub naught. We want to know, how does that behave? We're asking it to prove a theorem, not about itself, but about this whole thing. So suppose that it's a complicated system. We don't know what questions it's going to ask until we run it. Okay. So if we give it, put in some input, we run it to determine what question come out. Now, we have to say, what question are we putting in to begin with? That's a problem about some closed Turing machine. At this point, we don't know any of the later answers. So this is a Turing machine consisting of our intelligence system, the environment, the answering machine with no answers recorded yet. Then we figure out the answer, so we get sort of, let's sort of close Turing machine number one. We put the answer on. We put the answer on here. Then we're going to run it again to figure out answer number two. Output, input, and we'd like to figure out what we're going to do for answer number two, but we need to know question number two first. So we've got problem, question one, answer one we've determined. We ran the program, figured out what question, what error message we got. Here's the answer. And then we're going to run it until we get another question. We're going to figure out an appropriate answer. The problem we give it, however, is not the problem we gave it here. The problem here was about the first Turing, closed Turing machine with no answers. Here, our problem involves our new Turing machine with one answer on it. And then if we want, we keep going. And we're going to have a problem here. To figure out the questions, this is a sufficiently complicated thing, the only way we can expect to know what questions it asks is to actually run it. And once we know the questions, of course, we can get suitable answers. But the moment we know the answers, the questions changed. And we get clobbered by the fine-tuning problem.
You're imagining a human interacting with this machine?
Well,
finding the answer after the machine asks the question?
Sure. Just the way if I am a boss, I've got a mathematics department that solves useful problems for my company. You know, I can go in and I ask my mathematics department some questions, you know, typical behavior in industry. You know, typically you have to have an interaction.
But I guess what I'm missing here is, so this is some model about how, you know, intelligent machines might evolve or interact with people or something.
Yeah.
Is that addressing...
Yes. What I think everyone in this game says is that if an intelligent system can be made into a closed Turing machine, we get this contradiction right away. We say, humans can prove more theorems than the machine can. And this even tells you which theorem the machine can't prove. If you have the machine.
Is the boss an open Turing machine?
The boss, there are two steps here. There's the real boss, which is the programmer or the user. And let's say there's the boss's, the answering machine.
Now, is that an open Turing machine?
This itself is an open Turing machine, but because it's interacting with one other machine, the whole system is closed.
And it's all
Turing. Yeah.
Well, no, because you said that, you know, the answers that you record on the answering machine comes from the boss.
But
beforehand or during the
boss? No, not during the execution.
Right.
It's a closed Turing machine. So maybe I ought to go through this. It's a little confusing if you haven't met it before. So first step, I have open Turing machine, maybe coupled to an environment, but the environment, that's no problem. That's the flight simulator thing. This whole system is an open Turing machine and needs interaction with a boss to work. Okay, the question is, can we, out of that open machine, construct a closed machine to which we can apply Turing's theorem? So,
because people forget, they lose information. Once you connect machine with a person, then there is no...
Yeah. But that's not quite where I'm at. What I'm saying is, we have to get input to this beast. Now, if an ordinary closed machine is that we just give the input, let it run, and that's the end of the story. In fact, we can say a closed Turing machine, the kind you use here, is a general computer program which has one input statement, or is equivalent to having one input statement. So put one input statement in. Now, normally when we run this open machine, we'll have a boss here that's another intelligent being like the user or the program. Okay. Since the user is something outside the system we want to talk about, we don't care whether it is artificial, whether it's Turing or anything else. We just care that this is intelligent sufficiently. And we've got question one, answer one, question two, answer two, potentially an unbounded sequence of interactions. We don't know ahead of time how many interactions we're going to get. Then we say we're going to replace this beast by a closed Turing machine with one piece of input environment. Well, we have an answering machine here. Now, the answering machine, let's say it can be something fairly dumb. All we want to say is when we've got question number one, it's recorded, so when it gets question number one, it provides answer number one. When it gets question number two, it provides answer number two, etc.
And the answering machine is fixed before, independent of the input?
Independent, well, we choose what input we're going to put in.
Or you choose the answering machine?
And we, well, let's say we provide the table of answers here and the input all at the same time.
So if you could write, I mean, if the answering machine worked and it was capable of answering the questions correctly, why didn't you just pose the problem correctly in the first place?
Because what I don't know, well, I have to know what the problem is. I'm trying to figure out the best way of saying this. Part of the problem is we have what's potentially an intelligent thing here, but we don't know whether, we want to probe whether this object is intelligent. Now the problem is that this open system is going to continually be asking questions. We've got to provide it with answers.
But we are not assuming that in the course of that computation, the information is lost or randomly altered somehow.
No, not at all. We can have random loss or alteration, but we can do that completely algorithmically by using a random number generator. All I want to say is this whole machine is completely deterministic. That's all that's needed.
But there's a different machine for every set of inputs?
Yes.
Because you have three answers each time.
No. The answers are tailored to questions.
Yes.
And there's a big set of
questions. Yeah. So what I'm saying is I want the answer to a particular question. Now the problem is the system that's providing the answer is going to ask a lot more questions. I've got to give a lot more answers. Now, if it's directly interacting with me, okay, that's quite obvious. Anytime it gives a question, I can think about it and then give it input. Okay. The problem is that system's no good for putting in here, in the theorem. I can't get the contradiction because I've no idea whether the boss is a Turing machine, open or closed. All I know is I've got an intelligent boss.
But what prevents us from calling this closed system, Turing closed?
Because I don't know whether the boss is a Turing machine or not.
So that doesn't matter. This closed system is just a computer now.
This system?
No.
No, but this is not the boss. The boss has gone on vacation. The boss has left behind a series of responses that says, if this beast asks such and such a question, I provide such and such an answer.
So the question is whether you can construct an answering machine that works for arbitrary input.
Well, I'd be quite happy if I know what input I'm providing here. Okay. I'd be quite happy if it provides the correct answers for this particular input.
Okay. And you're saying that you can master it.
That's not going to work. Because suppose the input were prove a theorem about the open system, about T naught. Okay, I got to ask. Is this... was there a question?
I thought I'd like
to finish your sentence. Okay. What I wanted to do here was say, suppose this input were something about proving a theorem about T naught. Perfectly legitimate question to ask. Then the system comes back, asks the question. I know exactly what the question, then I can provide the input, and so on. So I can start off simulating, running the system as an open system and providing the answers myself. So let me see if I can do this. So first setup, we input is about input. Then I've got a series of questions and answers. I record the questions and answers. And then maybe sometime at the end, I get an answer. Then let me rerun the system. I give it the same input. I have an answering machine that's programmed with certain answers. It's going to be a totally dumb answering machine. This object is now a closed Turing machine given a certain input. It's purely deterministic, and therefore it will provide the same output. Let's call it O1. I will get the same output here. So if I give the same input each time, it's like demonstrating an interactive program. You give it some input with errors, you expect the error messages, you have responses to the error messages, and then you replace the real human by an answering machine. Okay, closed Turing machine. That's okay.
So how does this relate to the question of if you're talking to someone over the telephone, can you tell if it's a person or if it's a Turing machine?
If with difficulty, sometimes.
Then you could just replace the boss with a Turing boss, and it would be closest to that efficient.
Yeah, except remember what we're trying to prove here. We're trying to say we know we have intelligent beings around us, humans. We assume that humans are intelligent, but we don't know whether humans are Turing machines of any even the open kind. We may conjecture we are, but we don't know. But we do know we have humans.
So I guess it boils down to the
same question.
We're trying to figure out whether or not humans are Turing.
Yeah, so we've got a boss here, which may or may not be a Turing machine, but is intelligent, conscious. We've got a thing here that we know to be a Turing machine, but we don't know whether it's intelligent. So what might say, let's conjecture we have intelligence. We may, if it's possible to make this...
What do you call intelligence?
Well... we have to figure that. Well, I'm not quite sure, but let's assume we can figure out what intelligent and conscious means. Okay. I don't think I have to specify exactly what I mean for the purpose of this problem. Let's say we've got a boss that's intelligent and conscious, but we don't know whether it's a Turing machine.
Something that can prove the theorem that Turing
proves. Exactly. Okay. Now we've got a system here that's definitely an open Turing machine, at least of the open kind. I should say, as my terminology and not standard. Intelligent, we don't know. What I'd like to do is make a conjecture that this beast is intelligent, and what Penrose wants to do is obtain a contradiction. That's the great point. We say, Turing, definitely, but open. Intelligent, maybe. So we want to investigate the two possibilities and see whether we get contradictions. So if it's not intelligent, we're finished. And we want to exclude the possibility we've got something intelligent. So we've got an open machine here. So we want to be able to prove this without requiring that the boss be a Turing machine. Because if we get a contradiction that no machines can be intelligent, then the boss is obviously not a Turing machine. Okay. So, we can't assume Turing here. However, if we're to use the Turing-halting theorem, we must construct out of this system a closed Turing machine. If we can't do that, if we can't construct an appropriate closed Turing machine, we never get the contradiction we want. So what I'm trying to argue here is it's never possible to construct this closed Turing machine that does everything you want. So if you've got an open Turing machine, you have to provide
answers. I assume the boss was a Turing machine, you could do it.
That's a good question. If I have the boss intelligent and Turing,
and you could skip having the answers.
But wait a moment. There's a little problem here. I've got to get the whole system started. Because suppose I put the boss in here. Boss asks questions. How do you know the boss is going to ask this thing which comes down to the T of T? How do you know the boss is going to ask the right question? This is an autonomous system. It's going to develop somehow or other.
Well, if you imagine you're trying to construct a closed Turing machine, you still have to put an input from outside it. So the boss would not be starting the process anymore.
So I put some input in, but now let's assume this system and this system are intelligent. Maybe they even get to know each other and talk to each other and apply the Turing test and figure out they're both intelligent and communicate. Well, in that case, I might as well just replace my T0 here by this system. Because I've still got the problem of getting input in and not having my input dumped into the wastebasket because I'm thought a crank. And the only way, if an intelligent system's going to prove a complicated theorem, if it's going to behave, we can't assume it's any better than humans. And we know humans, in order to get involved with complicated mathematical theorems and debate orders, you have to allow them to question the orders. You have to have the interaction.
But that's not really true. I mean, I'm sure there's examples of people who have just got off on their own, not talking to anybody, and come up,
True. But he didn't have a boss telling him to prove a certain theorem and kill himself when he'd finished proving it. Which is effectively what you're telling the system to do. Prove this theorem and halt. For a human, that's prove this, do your job, and die. But you're giving a powerful incentive if it discovers what you're about to disobey you. And the problem is, you have to prove this theorem-proving software proves correct theorems. And you're liable to... I'm going off on another anti-Penrose tangent now. There's several lines of argument. But you have to be able to prove this software proves correct theorems and doesn't tell lies every so often. Okay? Now, it might be that if you prove the theorem, it will prove correct theorems and never tell lies, but only under certain conditions. And... So the idea is that if you take Ramanujan, someone going away, doing a lot of mathematics, not talking to anyone else, but you don't know that he had anyone telling him what theorems to prove. He was discovering theorems. So if the object of the exercise is simply to construct an intelligent system that proves interesting mathematics, and then you sort of put some kind of sensors on the system and figure out what theorems it's proving. That's no problem. But you never get you don't get the Turing contradiction because you're never telling this what theorem to prove. To get the Turing contradiction, you have to say this. You tell this object what theorem to prove. You insist on it giving its output by a certain signal.
But we have no idea that a human, if told to prove something which is as complicated as the entire brain of a human, could do that either, right?
True. But you might, well, if you've got something as complicated as the brain, what you don't know is if someone just walked into this room and said, go and work on this problem, you would not necessarily obey that person. Whereas if someone came in, sat down beside you and said, look, I know this interesting problem. Maybe it's going to turn you on as well. You talk about it. You have a long discussion. And maybe at the end of the discussion, your boss has persuaded you this is a good problem to work on. But if I'm a boss coming into this situation, I have to come into the conversation being prepared to be persuaded that maybe the problem I was going to assign was done. So you've got to allow for this interaction if you're dealing with real humans.
So you think the act of persuasion is somehow fundamental to this contradiction that Penrose is talking about? It looks like a mathematical computer science type contradiction. It doesn't like persuasion should be the key ingredient here.
But if you look at how I'm not quite sure whether persuasion is quite the right word, but something like that. But I'm saying whatever one has to do, you have that interaction. And what I'm saying is, if you don't have that interaction, then you get the Turing contradiction. So there are two ways you can... Maybe I can turn this around. If we've got the Turing theorem, we get a certain conclusion. Then we say, we take the Turing machine not as a proof that machines can't think, but as a requirement on the properties of machines that can think. So I'm saying, if we say, let me make a postulate, may not be exactly the right one, but all machines that think must be able to interact. Let's see, if a thinking machine is to be given an instruction to carry out a certain task, to guarantee the task gets carried out, you've got to permit arbitrary interaction with the with the boss. You can't, if the moment you put restrictions on the interactions, you may in fact lose access to the powers of the machine. I think I can state that better, but some theorem like that. Suppose you said that was a necessary requirement on intelligent machines. Then you could attempt, you could attempt to set up the answering machine business. That's the obvious solution. And the answering machine is going to work on a fixed problem, because this thing is a machine. Once it does something, you can switch it off, restart. But if if you don't know the question you're asking until you know the answers, because the question concerns this particular machine, you've got a problem. You don't know the questions until you know the problem. You don't know the problem until you know the questions. Chicken and egg. That I think. So if I asserted that intelligent machines must be able to do something like this in order to handle these problems, then I don't see how one can set up the closed machine that's needed for the theorem.
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
Well, what we are basically saying that thinking is similar as our physical structure. We are open systems, that's why we have metabolism. And in terms of thinking, we are also open systems because we exchange information.
Yes.
With other thinking machines, right? However, you can take the entire civilization together.
Yes.
And if you assume that no one else is thinking, then all this...
Then it's a closed system.
Yeah, it's a closed system, right? Is the Turing theorem applied to that closed system?
Turing theorem's irrelevant because of a... Because at some point you have to get you have to input the problem. So by definition, there's at least one interaction, an input interaction with the outside world. If you have a closed system, there's effectively one input interaction. You know, God sets up the initial conditions of the universe at the Big Bang. Nothing wrong with that. Or God sets the state of the universe in 4000 BC. Nothing wrong with that. But then, as long as God never interacts with the universe again, it doesn't really matter. So putting one input in is fine. But the problem is, to get the Turing argument working, you have to have the closed system. So you have, let's say we've just got the universe here.
Okay. Well, actually, it will never be a closed system because people forget. You just lose information.
But that's still a closed system.
I'm not sure.
Okay, two successive lines in a computer program. X equals 1, assign 1 to the variable X, assign 2 to the variable X. This erases memory of the first assignment. Okay, so that's perfectly deterministic and doable by machine. So machines can forget deterministically.
Deterministically,
when
people forget
indeterministically,
right?
Well, but you can put in a random number generator, which is fundamentally deterministic, to do that. And it's not obvious you lose anything by having a pseudo-random number generator.
Which is that when you forget something, there's something non-physical, like it's quantum gravity acting to make you forget.
Well, maybe, but do you need quantum gravity to make you forget? You know, there can be plenty of other mechanisms, and if you just say part of the functioning of the brain to work, it may have to degrade old information, they might even do that perfectly deterministically. In fact, it might even do it somewhat non-deterministically, because if they're things you keep working on or keep thinking about, it might preserve those memories, and others you don't use, it might forget. It might in fact choose which ones to forget. This is not maybe not a bad idea. That's adaptation to the real world. So I'm not sure that debt really messes up things. But I think the problem is that I still see this as the problem. If you have to get a closed system and you provide one definite input, and you have to say, with that input, you can persuade the system to prove a very complicated mathematical theorem. And if, and the now, for dumb computer software, you can maybe do that. But for intelligent software, it may be that if it's going to prove a complicated mathematical theorem, you require interaction. Okay, the moment you require the interaction, it basically now comes down to this self-referential thing. You don't know, and essentially you don't know quite what you're referring to, and if, when you do the T of T business, these two things have to be identically equal. And slightly different, even qualitatively the same, but just different in one insignificant bit, is not good enough. You've got to fine-tune the question and the machine to an unnatural amount.
So what is it that we can do and machines cannot?
What you mean? Well, that was the statement of the... That was what I got to in the Turing argument. If I have a closed machine that has satisfied the specification I gave about the theorem proving, then that system could not prove the theorem I gave it, that I did prove.
Maybe machines that, given this proof that you showed us,
yes,
could actually come up with the proof, no?
But remember, that system is in general not T.
Okay.
Now, if I have T primed proving a theorem about T, that's not the issue.
Fine, so...
It has to be a program proving a theorem. It's got to be exactly self-referential. Okay, so if I have some other program that knows about proving... Suppose I have some other program... T prime that knows how to prove T of T doesn't hold. That doesn't give me any contradiction.
No contradiction, but the question whether machines are intelligent or we are more intelligent than them, okay, that would mean that T prime is less intelligent than we are.
But T primed doesn't, if the intelligence resides in a closed machine, the closed machine of itself can't okay, let's see, I'm just trying, how do I say that? Remember the Turing theorem, you had this software that T of P.
Let's just
come back
at the level of general question. I mean, you say the Gödel and Turing together, they think that the machines cannot think.
Closed Turing machines.
The error of errors as ways is not to think about open Turing machines. That's the bottom line.
Well, he did think about them because that was the standard objection to his proof. But he gave basically arguments that involved, well, essentially the kind of thing I showed you, where you convert the open machine to a closed machine. A bigger closed machine.
You're saying you can't do that and then ask if this...
And then still have this contradiction. And in fact, remember what I said, right? Maybe we'd better go back and say what the specification of this thing is. This is a case where the fine print actually does matter. T of P is closed Turing machine, takes one argument, and it obeys a specification. So I really want to separate... So... T of P holds if and only if it has a correct proof. No, sorry, yeah, so on, that P doesn't hold. Now, I put an if and only if in there. That's critical. If sometimes it has a correct proof but decides to go and play on the beach or surf or something, that's not good enough. You know, it's like a mathematician. You prove a theorem, write it down, hide it in your desk and never publish it. You've still proved the theorem. And that doesn't help you get the contradiction. You have to get the knowledge out of the program. So you've got the specification here. So the claim, and I think really what I see here as being the claim, is that anything you can do on a computer is equivalent to a closed Turing machine. And the problem, generally, is if you say you've got some intelligent software, the problem is how do you get the input and output done? And if you put, and you may find you have intelligent software, but you can't put a wrapper around it. If you have intelligent, so suppose you have intelligent software, clearly we may have to put a wrapper around it to make it closed. Okay, so we have intelligent software, presumably an open Turing machine, and then we have a wrapper around it to make it a closed Turing machine, satisfying the right specification. Now, the intelligent software, we may have intelligent software that's as good as humans, maybe much better. But if we can't construct the wrapper, then Turing's theorem is simply inapplicable.
So it's a proof that God doesn't exist, right?
I'm not, how does that fall? I don't quite sure, see the, there's a jump there I didn't quite catch. So I think the idea, Turing's theorem says a program specifying a certain specification can't prove a certain, can't do a certain thing. But it may be that I can't find an algorithm obeying this specification. And if that's a problem of getting from intelligent software plus a wrapper to something I'm specifying this, maybe this step doesn't work.
I'm sorry, I thought you could always find a TFT.
I can provide you examples of TFP. The question is, if I've got some intelligent software, can I put a wrapper around it to make it into a closed Turing machine that obeys this specification? Now, I can...
I thought with a closed Turing machine, I can always construct a trivial TFP that simply takes every program, disregards the program, and goes into an infinite loop.
But, but remember there was an if and only if here.
Well, never all, so never as only.
Okay, but let me change the if and only if.
Never get the correct move.
But suppose I change this to saying T of P halts only if it has a correct proof.
Well, my thing will never halt. It will never have any proofs at all.
Oh, you're fine. No, that's fine. The moment I've got a program that goes in an infinite loop, we've got nothing to say. But suppose we have a program that halts only if it has a correct proof. So if it halts, you know it's got a correct proof of whatever. But if it doesn't halt, you conclude absolutely nothing. Okay. Suppose, for example, then you in fact don't get the contradiction. Because suppose you've got your open Turing machine, the wrapper around it. Suppose the open Turing machine proves the theorem you're interested in. But let's say it then goes and does something else and never returns to you. It doesn't halt. So suppose here's a Turing machine T.
Okay.
Given some input.
Fine, then you don't know what it is.
Then suppose the open software here proves that T of T does not halt. So it's intelligent software, so we can imagine it actually being perfectly conscious of this statement.
Right.
Then, so it proves a theorem, but let's say then it starts going off and proving other theorems. Maybe it makes a few other conjectures and things. It won't halt. It's proved a perfectly correct theorem.
Right.
The software doesn't halt.
So you don't.
Okay, so it's intelligent software. It's proved the theorem. It simply has avoided giving you answer in the approved form. You know, it's published in Nuclear Physics instead of Physical Review. Here you said it halts when. So if it's if and you only get the contradiction that Penrose needs if it's if and only if.
So the whole point is that the open system has to be intelligent and therefore proved.
Yeah.
So your infinite loop doesn't count if it's not intelligent. So then there are no contradictions because it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe this may be the best way of saying it. So as you've got theorem proving software, proves the theorem, and then goes and does some other mathematics. You can go in and investigate this system and verify that it has the proof. You can even read out the proof. But it doesn't report its result this way. And that's often what happens when we do real science. You ask a question, your boss comes in, or professor comes in, student, here's a problem. I'd like to know what the answer is. But you know, when it's just real research, a complicated problem, the answer may not come back in the form you're expecting. But you may still get a perfectly good answer. So the danger, and what you're doing here is saying, I must have the answer in a certain form. And you only get the contradiction if you put this requirement in. But in fact, I would say this is a counterexample. In fact, this is maybe the best counterexample. Open system, proves the theorem, keeps going. And you can't do anything within the system to change this behavior without changing the theorem.
You would say, TFP halts if it has a correct proof. And what?
Right. Let's say the three conditions we could put in, if and only if, and only if.
But you could have it to make different responses. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, if it has a correct proof, it does one thing, and if it doesn't have a correct proof, it does another thing, and that would also agree with this.
Not necessarily, because if you can think of all those signals ahead of time, you can simply replace the word halt does one of, and then you provide a list here. Yeah, okay. So that's like something bureaucratic. But the point is, you've got to set the list of requirements ahead of time in order to be able to state the theorem. Whereas in the real world, the form of getting an answer you may not know exactly what form the answer will take until you've got it.
But actually, if you said if it halts with 99% probability, that would also evade the problem. 99% of the time you get what you want.
Yeah. And the point is, it may fail, and the point here is, it may fail to halt and still have the theorem proved. And I really don't see how you get out of that at all. Okay. So, I think we're maybe at a halt. No. Yeah. Thank you.